beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile. My curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio. With no particular place to go. Riding along in my
WRCT Pittsburgh. Music for people on the go.
I sent you to tell her the way I feel. So I told her softly and sincere. And she leaned and whispered in my ear.
4 years ago, Texas experienced its worst blackout in state history. But there's one factor that never got much attention.
Natural gas failed in a big way.
The gas system that feeds many power plants simply didn't work. But why?
There's no plausible explanation for it other than a manipulation of price and a manipulation of supply.
Season 3 of The Disconnect, Power, Politics, and the Texas Blackout is out now. Find it at KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
My family had the most effect on my becoming a journalist. I came from a family of serious-minded scholars. I have five brothers and sisters, all of whom are holders of advanced degrees in one field or another. One of my brothers is a holder of two earned PhD degrees. So as you can see, ours is a family heavily oriented toward education and service. I grew up wanting most of all to write and spent most of my childhood experimenting with writing and concluded that it was the world for me. I saw so much that I thought needed to be described, communicated, explored, explained, and so forth. So that just became my outlet.
The late Robert C. Maynard, journalist, newspaper publisher, editor, and former owner of the Oakland Tribune newspaper. Maynard was a charismatic leader who changed the face of American journalism and built a four-decade career on the cornerstone of editorial integrity, community involvement, improved education, and the importance of the family. He was also co-founder of the Institute for Journalism Education, a nonprofit corporation dedicated to expanding opportunities for minority journalists at the nation's newspapers. In the 1980s, Maynard began a twice-weekly syndicated newspaper column in which he transformed national and international issues into dinner table discussions of right and wrong. When he bought the Oakland Tribune in 1983, he became the first African-American in this country to own a major daily newspaper. But Maynard had a career full of firsts, from being the first African-American national newspaper correspondent to being the first African-American newspaper editor-in-chief. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Life and Legacy of Robert C. Maynard in Black America.
Before I go on to say how that particular movement affected me personally, I want to say something about our profession that I think is an indictment of sorts. You know, we still have a ways to go toward full equality for blacks in America. But I think it's unfortunate that our media has not made it clear to the American people that what happened between 1950 and 1980, let's say, in America, 30 years, is probably one of the most phenomenal revolutions that's occurred in human history. To take the condition that blacks were in those days and to see the number of barriers that fell and the number of conditions that changed and the number of opportunities that present themselves today versus in that day. And it's a remarkable march. And black Americans should take greater pride in what we have already accomplished. That does not mean we should slacken in what we feel we need to continue to accomplish. But we should not allow ourselves, or deny ourselves, I should say, we shouldn't deny ourselves a justly deserved compliment.
The late Robert C. Maynard was a dynamic leader in American journalism. throughout the 1970s and 1980s. He was the first African-American to own a major metropolitan daily newspaper. Maynard was the publisher of the struggling Oakland Tribune from 1983 until 1992. Through that newspaper and the Institute for Journalism Education, which he co-founded in 1976, he became instrumental in training and placing minority journalists in important positions nationwide. Born on June 17, 1937 in Brooklyn, New York, Maynard was the son of immigrants from Barbados. Interested in writing at an early age, he frequently cut class at Boys High School to hang out at the editorial office of a black weekly newspaper, the New York Age. In 1967, Maynard was hired by the Washington Post as national correspondent, the first African-American to hold that position on any major newspaper. In 1977, he left the Washington Post and moved to the University of California, Berkeley, to found the Institute for Journalism Education. In 1979, he was hired by Gannett as editor in the newly acquired Oakland Tribune newspaper. When he purchased the Oakland Tribune in 1983, he became the first African-American in this country to own a major daily newspaper. In 1985, Maynard was the recipient of the Whit Carter Reddick Award from the College of Communication at the University of Texas at Austin.
Langston had just put on a play called Simple Sings the Blues. And Jimmy Baldwin was just about to publish Notes of a Native Son. This was a period in Afro-American history that I was privileged to be the witness to, which was the moral preparation for the civil rights movement. That's what was going on in the middle to late 50s when I was traveling among this group of writers. They were raising the moral questions that would set the stage for Martin Luther King, for Malcolm X, and for the whole struggle that then ensued. The history of the movement up to that time is important to keep in context. Let me just go back 100 years. At the end of the Civil War, there was an attempt to bring blacks into some sort of economic participation and political participation in the South through Reconstruction, as it was called. Reconstruction collapsed in about the 1880s, and little by little, black people slipped into a status of semi-servitude. Yes, no longer slaves, but no, not quite free. And in that context came along a Supreme Court ruling called Plessy versus Ferguson, which decreed that as long as the state provided equal facilities for blacks, they could be separate. And that doctrine, separate but equal, is what prevailed from 1896 to 1954. Now, separate but equal was just a code word for segregation of the rankest sort. There was nothing the least bit equal about the treatment of blacks and whites in the South at that time. During World War II, black Americans went off, as you know, and distinguished themselves in war and died fighting for the freedom of this country. It was the people who came home in 1945, having fought and bled and seen their buddies die for democracy and freedom elsewhere, who began to plot the course for the overthrow of Plessy. They were lawyers primarily, you know, people who went to law school and set up shop at Howard University and used that as the launching pad for this assault on the second-class status of blacks in America. And as that battle began to heat up in the middle 50s, young writers and established writers began to try to define the black experience for public understanding so that white people could understand better. This was the period when Jimmy Baldwin wrote so eloquently about the status of blacks in the minds of whites. He said, you know, a nigger is not a person. A nigger is an idea. Why do you need a nigger? You know, what is it in your life that makes you need to see somebody else as being inferior? And he kept probing that question. And of course, you know, Langston was going at it from another side with the stiletto of satire. And other writers were grappling with it in different ways. And of course, the writers and the clergy and the activists of various kinds all finally began to sing off of one song sheet, as it were, into the middle of the 1950s. And so the Supreme Court, clearly hearing that the moral outcry had reached a level where this could no longer be tolerated, finally declared segregation legally void and replaced the evil doctrine of Plessy against Ferguson with the new doctrine of Brown against Board of Education. And from that moment, there grew the movement that eventually led to Dr. King and others marching on Selma and from Selma to Montgomery. And that ended, finally, the period of legalized separation of the races in this country. What it did not do is liberate our minds. It liberated our bodies. We became, at least physically, able to move about freely in American society. But the presupposition remained that we were intellectually still suffering from the legacy of slavery. We were still, our minds were still enslaved. And so the struggle since the mid-60s has been more of an intellectual struggle. It has been a struggle to establish our right to be viewed as equal in jobs that had previously been regarded as strictly, quote, white jobs. Newspaper editors, judges, physicians, you know, the whole range of places that we had been denied access in large numbers. Well, as we begin to fan out, as it were, from that from the enclosure of segregation into the broad society, we discover that we're not all exactly the same in the way we view the world, that to be successful in the world, we have to learn a variety of skills because there are all sorts of new challenges now that we should be working toward. And so I see my becoming an editor and owner of a major daily newspaper as being on the cutting edge of the opening up of this new arena of possibilities for the mind, which I think is every bit as important as what the previous era did to free our bodies.
You went to work for the Afro-American in Baltimore, and I assume that established you at a major American newspaper. Were you comfortable in coming to the Post after working at the Afro-American in Baltimore?
Well, I didn't go straight from the Post. Okay. I went first to a newspaper in Pennsylvania, the York Gazette.
Okay.
And I worked there for 6 years. Then I was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. Then, as you say, I met Ben Bradley while I was at Harvard as a Nieman Fellow. And he invited me to come and see him at the Post, and I did. And I had no discomfort, about coming there. I felt very good about it. It was a fabulous experience for me.
You said you learned a particular lesson. And I guess the illustration that they used in one of the particular articles, I think it was in Players Magazine, that you had written a person that had red paint thrown on his automobile, mm-hmm. and you somewhat was going to make a satire out of that experience, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. your editor came to you, and it didn't come to you, he had whacked your particular story, mm-hmm. and you came to him and asked him why did he do this particular. Could you expound on that more as far as making an impression on you as a journalist? And
well, let me start. Let me tell the whole story so that everybody will know what we're talking about. In my first day as a police reporter on the York Gazette, I went out to cover, to do what they call collecting the police blotter, where you go down to the police headquarters and you take down all these various complaints and so forth, and you write one-paragraph stories about fender benders and so on. It's part of your early training. And I saw one complaint that said that John Smith had complained to the police that he had just that Saturday afternoon bought a brand new blue Pontiac convertible, and he parked it outside of his house overnight, and when he came out in the morning, somebody had smeared red paint all over this brand new car. So he complained to the police. I wrote down the complaint, and I came back to the office, and I decided to write a funny story. And as I recall it, my story began, if John Smith had wanted a red convertible, he would have bought a red convertible. Instead, he bought a blue convertible. But last night, somebody tried to paint it red, da-da-da, and went on to tell his story. Well, after I turned my story in, I went back over to the city editor's desk, and I looked over his shoulder, and he was crossing out all that stuff about if John Smith had wanted a red convertible. And so I said, why did you take all that out? He said, well, let me ask you a question. Why did you put it in? I said, well, I thought it was funny. He said, well, if you had been John Smith, would you still think it was funny? And I stopped and I thought about it and I said, well, no. And he said, well, that's my point. He said, when we sit down here to write stories, we must never allow ourselves to indulge in our exercise of humor at the expense of some ordinary citizen. And to me, it was the most profound single lesson about the impact of what we do. It was a lesson that, as you can tell, has remained with me for over 25 years. And whenever I think about what we do as journalists, I always want to ask the question, what's the impact on the other fellow, or the other woman, as the case may be? What are we doing to people? And shouldn't we be sensitive about that? Rather than just say, well, I think it's funny to ridicule this person. Let's have some fun. Well, maybe that's not always appropriate.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment.
Hi, I'm Lori Gallardo, and I have just one question for you. What is the darkness to you?
Dark to me now is fear.
What is dark to you? It seems like a morbid question at first, but some answers may surprise you.
Dark is actually inspiration to me, I think. As weird as that sounds.
That's the idea behind my new podcast, SPF 1000 Vampire Sunscreen, where I have conversations with all kinds of people from all walks of life about what they define as the darkness. You can find SPF 1000 Vampire Sunscreen at KUTX.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now on with our conversation.
Was it easy for you or difficult for you to be objective when you covered the civil rights movement and Dr.
Sure.
Martin Luther King?
Oh, sure it was. It was, and I tried very hard to avoid becoming a press agent for the movement.
Okay.
I had to cover the news. I had to write balanced stories that took into account that not everybody in the movement was perfect and that not everything, even everything that Martin Luther King did, was perfect, that nobody's perfect. And even though I had enormous sympathy for what the movement was trying to accomplish, I tried to distinguish the goals of the movement from the everyday behavior of individuals and see that for whatever it was. I never allowed, in my mind, any source, including Martin Luther King, to be larger than life.
What effect covering that movement have on your life personally today?
Enormous, in the sense that if you could have seen the condition of the political, economic, and social status of Black Americans in the South, particularly in 1950, which is around the time I began to be aware of things outside myself, you wouldn't recognize that condition versus the condition of Blacks today. And before I go on to say how that particular movement affected me personally, I want to say something about our profession that I think is an indictment of sorts. You know, we still have a ways to go toward full equality for Blacks in America. But I think it's unfortunate that our media has not made it clear to the American people that what happened between 1950
in 1980, let's say, in America, 30 years, is probably one of the most phenomenal revolutions that's occurred in human history. To take the condition that blacks were in those days and to see the number of barriers that fell and the number of conditions that changed and the number of opportunities that present themselves today versus in that day. And it's a remarkable march, and black Americans should take greater pride in what we have already accomplished. That does not mean we should slacken in what we feel we need to continue to accomplish, but we should not allow ourselves, or deny ourselves, I should say, we shouldn't deny ourselves a justly deserved compliment for what we as a people have done to change our own status in a relatively short period of time. Even though we know we have a long way to go, part of the way you get there is through recognizing what you've already accomplished, because hope is key to all accomplishments. And we have accomplished more than we generally recognize, more than the news media stop and acknowledge from time to time, as I feel we in the news media should. What I saw as a journalist is this. I saw a people in a condition of almost total social and political paralysis. And I saw black people galvanize their energies and their forces and focus on specific targets and obliterate those targets and change a condition. In 1961, when the sit-ins began at Greensboro and at in Nashville, there were probably a dozen black elected officials in the 11 states of the old Confederacy. And today there are over 4,000 black elected officials. That's revolutionary. All of a sudden, all of these popularly elected officials are seeing their names in print associated with all sorts of misdeeds, some of them fanciful, some of them for real. And lo and behold, their accusers were all anonymous. And it left a very bad taste in the public's mouth. The latest surveys show that more than half the public, 54%, will discount a story that contains anonymous sources as unreliable. They just won't touch it.
Will you as an editor accept a piece with unnamed sources in it?
Not unless it meets a set of fairly clear standards. First of all, there must be an allegation of a violation of public trust. In other words, it's got to be serious. Number two, it must be information that could not be obtained on the record with people's names attached. Number three, some senior editor of the newspaper must know the name of the alleged source. And four, there can't be just one source. There have to be two independent corroborative sources. Under those four standards, yes.
You spoke earlier today about credibility within the journalism profession. Two particular incidents have particularly affected the credibility of black journalists. The Janet Cook incident and recently the Jaime incident with Milton Coleman of the Washington Post and the presidential candidate Jesse Jackson. In your opinion, has that drastically hurt black journalists overall, those two incidents?
No, not drastically. The Janet Cook case looked as if people could say, well, gee, there's something unique about it. But there wasn't anything unique about it. In very short order, we had the case of Michael Daley of the New York Daily News going off to Belfast and writing a story that he saw a group of British troops do something that didn't happen. And then we had Christopher Jones write an article for the New York Times Magazine about Kampuchea. And it turned out that he was in Madrid all the time that he said he was in Cambodia. Then you had the case of the AP reporter writing this strange freeway phantom story. So there have been a number of other fabrications. So no, I wouldn't say that there's anything about that that speaks specifically to black journalists. In the case of the so-called Haimetown incident, I think there's something to be said about that that I have not seen or heard a great deal. And so let me tell you what I think. And I haven't said this
because I want to say, is this a unique incident where you're privy to information off the record?
Well, that's what I want to talk about.
Okay.
What I want to say about that incident is this. What it reflected was the inexperience of both men at what they were doing. Okay? Jesse Jackson is inexperienced in elective politics. He has been accustomed to being in an arena in which he could function without the usual checks and balances that go into political reporting. It's just a different world. And he didn't know that. And so he thought he could do some things that he did in another arena, in another setting, and get away with it in this much different setting. So it was a case of a learning experience for him about how you open your mouth about journalists when you're a candidate. Now, having said that, I have to say on the other side that Milton was equally inexperienced in such matters. And what Milton didn't understand is that in every political campaign, there are always certain areas of understanding between reporters and candidates about the sorts of things that will be allowed to be off the record. Now, in the case of such obnoxious language as Haimetown, I don't think there ought ever to be a rule for that sort of thing to be permissible, for candidates to use that kind of language. Because if it's okay for Jesse to say, Haimetown, what do you do if you're equally beholden to a white candidate and they say a racist or a sexist remark? Should a white journalist not report that? He's a putty now. He feels as if he's got a certain camaraderie with the candidate and vice versa, just as Jesse felt he had with the black reporters. Suppose such a white candidate starts using racial epithets in those private circumstances or anti-Semitic epithets. Should that be okay? Should the press, should the reporters close to him say, oh, well, it's off, all of his racial epithets are off the record? That doesn't work either, does it?
No.
Okay, so what Milton needed to know is, well, how do you handle that? And the way I think he should have handled it is when he heard Jackson use that sort of language the first time in a so-called off-the-record setting, whatever that might have been, he should have said to him, hey, look, I find that offensive. I think that that even speaks to the character of this campaign. And I don't think, since this is off the record, I don't think I will report it the very first time. But I want you to know that if I determine that that's a pattern with you, that you do use that sort of language all the time, it may become part of your profile as I have to report it. And I think that would have cleaned it up. But he didn't have the experience to know that that's what you do. We call it in political reporting one bite of the apple. Every guy, every candidate, every person, man or woman, should have one chance in the early stages of a campaign to make a mistake, because we all do, without us blowing it up. But if we find that that mistake, so-called, at first, begins to reveal itself as a pattern that tells us something about the character of the person, then we should put them on notice that we intend to use that material in a story.
The late Robert C. Maynard, former editor and publisher of the Oakland Tribune newspaper. Maynard died on August 17, 1993. He was 56. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Next up, we have our Ebony Spectrum features.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black, but I'm going to keep it brief. I'm sorry. It's been a long week, and I don't really got a whole lot of sophisticated words for this. But Senator Schumer, don't be a hoe. Hell, who knows? It could have already been a hoe by the time this video comes out. But here's the sticky icky. The people are mad at Senator Schumer out of New York because just a few days ago, he was talking about how House Republicans proposed a continuing resolution bill to prevent a government shutdown. But they did so without any Democratic input whatsoever. And at first, he was very big and bad on Instagram talking about because there was no Democratic input, you won't have any Democratic votes. But just yesterday, it was seeming as though he folded, like a lawn chair at that. Talking about the government shutdown is exactly what Donald Trump wants. And he may not be wrong about that, because on the one side, a government shutdown could give Trump and Elon Musk the opportunity to gut federal agencies even more, prioritizing the ones they want to keep, or even filling the few seats left with preferred personnel. But on the other hand, this continuing resolution, or CR, would result in Democrats once again being held by the Republican Party. What is a CR, you ask? It's a proposal to stop any foreseen gap in the functioning of federal agencies and provide them with funding to operate for an extended period of time. This one has a funded plan through September, but there are no concrete plans for said funds, and that's dangerous for a duo that's already firing hella people and wasting and or hoarding taxpayer dollars on bullshit. Representative Rosa DeLauro of the House Appropriation Committee says it's not just a simple stopgap that keeps the lights on and doors open. This is the Republican Party handing over the keys to the government and a blank check to Elon Musk and President Trump. Donald Trump himself has already spent $18 million on golfing trips to Florida within his first 54 days in office. He's also wasting taxpayer dollars with his charade of immigration reform, transporting immigrants back and forth to Guantanamo Bay, a facility that doesn't even have the capacity to house the majority of these immigrants, a majority of which are here legally and have no business being rounded up in the first place. And the State Department is conveniently and quietly mulling over a $400 million deal over armored military Tesla trucks while Tesla stock is plummeting. Now, in order for this bill to pass, it needs votes from 8 Democrats. And we're already mad at 10 House Democrats for voting to censure Representative Al Green last week at the joint address. Senator John Fetterman says that you never vote for a shutdown, that that's chaos, and that he will never vote for chaos. Voting for a CR is voting for chaos. Just be a man about it. And just last weekend, I gave this whole spiel about how disappointment with the Democratic Party leading to the withdrawal of our support can be misguided. That we have a job and they have a job and that we're supposed to be working together. That they aren't responsible for doing all the work while we sit at home literally twiddling our thumbs. But this some whole shit. And yeah, the Republicans are bullying y'all, but if you want to stop being hoed, maybe stop being a hoe. Senator Angela also Brooks isn't being a hoe. Bernie Sanders isn't being a hoe. Van Hollen, Chris Murphy, Hakeem Jeffries, AOC, the list goes on. I just hope y'all left Senator Schumer up there by himself. I had a whole episode written about special elections in Florida to help flip the House, but shit has hit the fan twice with Democrats in 1 week, and y'all can't sit still for one moment just to let us trust y'all a little bit. And while we're here, let's talk about it for just a second, because I don't trust y'all. Not as a conglomerate. Wouldn't trust some of y'all to teach your child to cover your mouth when they sneeze. However, I am expecting you to act like you know somebody that knows somebody that knows something about being a good partner and working with the American people. There is one whole Republican senator, Senator Rand Paul, who said last week that he's going to refuse to vote on the plan unless it outlines the cuts led by Elon Musk. How he got more backbone than the people in the literal opposing party. I don't know, maybe I need to change the music you're listening to. Put on Real Big by Manny Fresh. Not If You Buck by Crime Mob. A little trap music in the morning does wonders. But no, real shit. The economy is tanking because of our president's erratic behavior. Firing people, throwing up tariffs left and right, taking them down when he feel like it just as quickly. And this current CR would effectually increase groceries, cut cuts to health care, to education, care for veterans. And at this rate, a 12-month recession is on the way for sure. Damn. So it's still both and. We got to get them seats in Florida on April 1st. We'll talk about it next week. All right, bye.
Next up here is Don Lemon.
Now, for the folks who are asking, what did you ask about the Jewish students? Of course I'm thinking about the Jewish students on campus. Of course I'm thinking about them. So let's hear from a Jewish person who understands the nuances of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and also being a Jewish person. He's not so far from college age. He's a pretty young man. John Lovitz, make sure you play from the very beginning, please.
Let me to put on my Jew hat for a moment. I'm actually wearing a deli hat, so it is. I'm literally wearing a Jew hat today. Let's say that this person had a bunch of anti-Semitic comments. Protected. Anti-Semitism is protected speech. I don't like it. I don't like a lot of what I heard at some of these protests that I do think go from anti-Zionism into pure anti-Semitism on the regular. But like to see the Anti-Defamation League put out a comment with this sort of to be sure at the end about everyone deserving due process, but ultimately coming down on the side of what the Trump administration is doing is so fucking stupid. The idea that like be a kind of patron to what Trump's doing, be like a good Jew who supports the regime, that'll protect us in the end. The thing that like protects Jewish people from anti-Semitism is the culture of freedom, a legal order that protects freedom, including the freedom of green card holders, not just citizens, but non-citizens in this country. That protection is ultimately what makes Jews safe in America. The idea that going down a road in which people think it is defensible for the Trump administration to come knocking on somebody's door who has not been accused of a crime to revoke their immigration status for speech and protests you don't like, it's obviously morally reprehensible, but it is so fucking stupid in the long term. That makes every Jewish person in America less safe. Think about the road we're going on. It's like there are posters in the schools. They say first they came for the socialists. Yep. What do they think comes after that? And then they were cool? Like, it's so stupid. It's so obvious. And like, there's all these people that have pretended to care about history and to learn from history and think about history. And it's happening right in front of our faces. And they're too either cynical or naive to realize that they're the people not doing the right thing in the moment when they're supposed to.
Thank you very much. Did you guys understand that everything has nuance? Everything, there's a nuance to everything, and you can be Jewish and understand that. I don't agree with them. But I think he has a right to due process and a right to freedom of speech. I want to bring in Dave Ehrenberg. He is an American politician, serves as a state attorney of Palm Beach County, Florida, 2013 to 2025. Also, we call him the Florida lawman.
It's great to be back with you, Don.
Yeah. Good to be back. Yes, lemon law. This case is really bothering me. It's got me down. It's really thrown me off kilter. What's happening here?
Well, here's the thing. What this guy is in jeopardy of being deported for is that he may have been espousing support for a terrorist organization. And under the law, it says that, according to law, I'm going to read it for you here. The Immigration Nationality Act, it says that you're allowed to deport any alien who endorses or espouses terrorist activity or persuades others to endorse or espouse terrorist activity or support a terrorist organization. Now, it is a pretty broad sentence there, but does the administration have legitimate grounds to win this in the courts that he would be deported? Yes. And I know people say, well, First Amendment rights. Yeah. But people on green cards don't have the same exact First Amendment rights as
Dave. I agree with you on that. But where's the evidence? Why haven't they charged him with anything? Where is the evidence that he has ties to Hamas,
right,
or a terrorist organization?
Well, first off, you don't have to have a crime to be deported, right? So the fact that he's not charged with a crime does not matter. It matters what he does, and includes what he says. So when people say First Amendment, look at his actions, not his words. Well, you can look at his words as well. And Don, that's where I keep an open mind, because I want to see exactly what he did and said. I know that for Jewish students at Columbia who were threatened and hassled and couldn't go to school because of guys like this, they probably are breathing a sigh of relief that he's no longer around to terrorize them. But whether that's deportable or not, I think that's for a judge. And that's where he does have due process rights. He has not been deported. He's going to go see a judge, and this will be settled in the courts.
Okay, so those due process rights, that means they can arrest him and detain him before they decide on what they're even charging him with or what they want to deport him for? Can they just say, hey, I imagine if you're on a visa or whatever, they can just tell you to leave anytime for no reason or whatever. They can make up a reason, but he does not. Doesn't he have due process rights as someone who has a green card as a permanent resident?
He does. He does. But you don't have to be charged or convicted of a crime to be sent home based on the specific wording of the Immigration Nationality Act. Also, there's another provision that Marco Rubio is referring to as Secretary of State that does give the Secretary of State broad power to deport someone who is a threat to our national security. But you've got to have the goods. You've got to have evidence that he has expressed support for Hamas or he's done something that exhibits support for Hamas. And so, or is part of a terrorist group. Now, I don't know all the details about it, but that's why this is not, as like your last speaker was very passionate about it. I get it. But this is not so cut and dry. This guy has done some really bad things, okay? He has been terrorizing Jewish students on campus. Whether or not that's deportable, well, let's see.
Well, I want to know, is there evidence that he has been terrorizing Jewish students? Is there evidence that he has ties to Hamas or that he is a Hamas sympathizer? That's what I think everyone is asking. And so far, Marco Rubio or Tom Homan or no one has actually shown any evidence. That is what people are concerned about. And I've said here, if you show me some evidence that any of this is true, then I'll say, okay, fine. But if someone tries to detain me and they say, Don, we're coming to pick you up, and I would say, well, on what grounds are you picking me up? They don't have to show evidence on what grounds that they're picking me up and they're detaining me. It seems like that would just be a basic right of an American citizen or even one who is here on a...
That's the difference. He's not an American citizen. He's here on a green card, and he's subject to the rights and responsibilities of those on a green card. And if you espouse support for a terrorist organization or espouse views that are in line with Hamas, you could be deported for that. And just a matter of how aggressive the INS officials want to be. And this administration is getting very aggressive. And I don't know if he has ties to Hamas. But you ask...
Well, that's the thing you're saying. If you espouse views and you don't know, that's the whole point. It says he is a legal permanent resident and he has a green card. And so that's the thing. Where is the evidence that this has happened? If there is evidence that he did that, I would say, Dave, you're right, 100%. But where's the evidence? And the judge stopped him from being deported. Where is that evidence? Why didn't they present that evidence? Why aren't they not presenting that evidence to the American people right now?
Well, they don't have to present it to the American people. They have to present it to a judge. And the judge is going to make that decision based on the evidence. So you're right that they have to come up with the goods. And as far as whether or not he has intimidated and threatened and terrorized Jewish students, which, by the way, that in itself is not necessarily deportable. That to me, it just shows that he's not a good guy. But I've spoken to several students from Columbia, and they have felt very intimidated on campus, where the encampments and their classes.
Dave, I understand that. But that's not the point. And I have been on college campuses for protests here and when I was a student. And I have been very uncomfortable on college campuses.
Right.
I would not want the people who made me uncomfortable on college campuses picked up and deported because I did not agree with them or because they blocked me from class. Now, if they threatened my being, okay, that's something else. But because someone blocked you from class, okay, yeah, you want to go to class. But that is not like it is a crime that is beyond the pale. It is something that a college student is doing. College students, I believe, should be given wide berth and to be allowed to push and to test the system. So I don't know if I agree with you about that. Now, the law is the law and whatever the judge decides.
Right.
But I think that at this point, if you are going to pick someone up and you are going to detain them, then you need to tell them and you need to show the evidence. And it appears to me right now there is no evidence. Otherwise, they would have showed the government and they would have said, hey, this is the evidence we have. And boom, now Marco Rubio is saying this is not about free speech. Tom Homan is saying this is about free speech. Somebody's lying somewhere. Someone doesn't have their story together, because if they had the goods, they would have presented it by now. The judge is saying, bring me some evidence.
Right.
And so it's up. So something is not right in the detaining of this person. Shouldn't, before you detain someone, you have the evidence for what you're saying, and not just, well, he might be, and he could have done this, and maybe he's a sympathizer, and maybe he's not. Shouldn't it be like, he's a sympathizer on June such and such of 2024. He did this and said this at a rally, which is of concern to the students and the American people. On May whatever 2024, he blocked this student from going to class. He was leading a protest that stopped the students. I'm not seeing it, Dave. I'm sorry. I hate to disagree with you on this. I know the law is the law, but I hate to disagree with you.
Well, I don't know if we're totally disagreeing, Don, in that I'm waiting to see the evidence too. I'm not saying they don't have it or they do have it, because they're going to have to present it to a judge to deport him. They can't deport him unless they have something specific. And
you're saying they don't have to have that evidence before they detain someone?
Well, yeah. Well, as immigration goes, there's very broad authority for the president, the secretary of state. For example, the Immigration Naturalization Act actually says that the president can suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens who are deemed to be detrimental to the interests of the United States, and they can impose upon them any restrictions that the president may deem to be appropriate. So there is broad power. And with Marco Rubio is saying, it's not about free speech. It's about this guy is a threat to our national security.
You're giving me hypotheticals, and you're saying that if there's what is deemed to be detriment to the United States, who's
right? Well, hold on.
How is that deemed to be detrimental to the United States when we thrive on free speech and people having dissenting opinions? That's part of the fabric of America that we espouse and that we love, because we want people who freedom of religion, people have different ideas about political parties. So how is that deemed to be detrimental to the United States? Because you are expressing a First Amendment right that American citizens express, that is expressed here in America.
If it's just his speech about his opposing a two-state solution, he wants the elimination of Israel, that's not going to be enough to deport him. What would be enough is if he endorsed October 7th and Hamas. If you endorse October 7th and say that it should happen again, then yes, then you should be deported.
100%. 100% I agree with you. But where's the evidence? That's what I'm asking you. Before, if someone came to pick up Dave Ehrenberg and detain you, what would you say to them? Why?
Well, I'm different because I'm a U.S. citizen. This guy is okay, not a U.S. citizen.
I'm asking you, but wouldn't you say what? Why?
I would say, what are the charges? But that's different than if I'm on a green card where you can detain people because they're deemed to be a threat to the United States. Now, you have to come up with the goods. And that's why you have a judge and you're going to have hearings. So I don't think
States, Dave, what I'm trying to tell you is that where is the evidence of him deemed to be a threat of the United States? Why are we picking
the United States or someone who's espoused support for a terrorist organization? So if you go ahead and you say, let's have another October 7th, then that would be enough.
Okay, but I just said that to you. If you said on June, whatever, said that he was in support of October 7th. But where is that?
Well, like I said, it's going to have to be proven to a court or else he's not going to be deported. But the question is, should the United States government, do they have the power to do this? The answer is yes. And can they do it for this guy? Well, the devil's in the details.
Should they do it?
It depends on
the evidence. Are you okay with people just being picked up on just the suspicion of something with no evidence?
Oh, no evidence? If they had no evidence, then they wouldn't have picked him up. They picked him up because he was the leader of these infamous campus protests that Jewish students felt were threatening to them and universally are seen as something that is not in line with American values. Yeah, I'm telling you, man.
That's no evidence of that, because you disagree with someone. There's no evidence that they are espousing terrorism or have links to terrorism.
There's
no evidence. Now, if he had said the things that you said, okay, great. But
that's what the hearing is for.
Send me a speech.
But that's what the hearing is for. And obviously, he's already seen the judge. He's got due process. So when you say he's being He's being arrested. First of all, he's not being arrested. He's on a green card. He's on an immigration hold, and he could be deported because they have to show that he is someone who is a danger to the national security of the United States or someone who's espousing support for terrorist organizations. So I assume that the time that they got him, they have enough evidence. And as far as whether we're going to see it, we're going to have to see it or else he's going to stay in the country.
Okay, Dave, you've been doing this for a long time. Do you know of people that have been picked up without any evidence? On the suspicion of something and there is no evidence that it's actually there. Has that ever happened? Because you said they must have the evidence, otherwise they would not have done it.
Yeah, of course they've got to have some evidence. They can't just do it based on the fact that he hates Israel or even the fact that he posts anti-Semitic stuff on social media, which he does, but that's not enough to deport. That's just enough for me to think he's a bad dude. So I'm the one saying that the government has broad powers to keep him and deport him, and then they have to provide evidence. So we're not that far off. I guess you would be a little less willing to use the government's powers to...
Well, I'm a little different because of my interactions, perhaps, with law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Because I know people and have been... People say this is suspicious when they have had no evidence. You are doing this. You are acting suspiciously as someone who has been racially profiled in a store, right, in a retail store with no actual evidence of anything happening. People just sort of walking around and following me and then calling the police when I have a receipt in my pocket. Mm-hmm. So to say that someone is because there is a suspicion of something that someone automatically has the evidence, for me, honestly, as a black person, that is bullshit. Because there is no, I've had the cops called on me for shoplifting, Dave, when I had a receipt in my pocket. There was no evidence except in someone's mind, I was suspicious. And so I cannot believe that you are here as a member of, you know, the courts and the law enforcement saying they must have evidence or otherwise they would not have done it. I'm sorry, that's hard for me to swallow. I don't get it. I want to know when you arrest me or detain me, where is the evidence that I am guilty of what you are accusing me of? Otherwise, I don't feel, and perhaps I'm not within the law, that you have the right to detain me unless you have some hard evidence that you are going to show in court in a due process in a matter of time where my family is not looking all over the world for me and you are not telling me and you don't feel obliged or obligated to tell my attorney or my 8-month pregnant wife where I am. That just seems un-American to me, unpatriotic, and not what we are about in this country. I could be wrong. And then I'm just saying, if they have the evidence, fine, then I will change it. But something is just not sitting right with this. And I don't understand why you're saying they have to have the goods because of the suspicion when they have not presented it so far. And there's this whole big rigmarole going out around. And I think that they would want to tamp that down.
You've talked about Trump needing to show Canada respect.
President Trump.
President Trump, yes. President Trump needs to show Canada respect. You said that again just now. Are you not going to speak with President Trump until he cuts out this 51st state talk?
No, I look forward to speaking with President Trump, just to be clear. We respect the United States. We respect President Trump. President Trump has put some very important issues at the top of his agenda. We understand his agenda. We understand the importance of addressing the scourge of fentanyl, which is a challenge here in Canada as well as the United States. And I would say that the measures that have been put in place in recent weeks in Canada and Mexico, also the United States, means that we are making tremendous progress. I'll speak specifically for Canada, against fentanyl. We understand the importance President Trump places on American workers and American jobs. We want him and his administration to understand the importance we put on Canadian workers and Canadian jobs. And we will look for avenues to work together so that both objectives are met in terms of both our great economies, just as we are doing, and the people behind me have led this, just as we are doing with respect to the scourge of fentanyl.
Canada has officially sworn in a new prime minister. Mark Carney, a central banker turned politician, took his oath earlier today after the resignation of Canada's longtime leader, Justin Trudeau. Trudeau, who spent more than 9 years as prime minister, bid farewell and thanked Canadians on X, calling them the best country and the best people on earth. CNN's Paula Newton is here with more on this. So, Paula, Carney's background is in finance. It's not in politics, much like Trump's when he first became U.S. president. What kind of leader is he expected to be, and how can he handle this current trade crisis?
Well, I think in certain levels, in terms of style, much differently than Justin Trudeau. I think right down to the dark blue suit and the gray tie that he wore today to be sworn in, Brianna, there really was a contrast. This is an economist. He is a serious man. He did, I will say, go out of his way to point out the similarities with Donald Trump, that he has cut big deals in real estate, and that he did have some ties to the Trump administration in its first instance. I want you to listen now, though, to something that irks him and irks so many Canadians about the fact that the president continues to talk about the 51st state, and he explains why that will never happen. Listen.
I've been clear. Personally, I've been clear. The ministers behind me, I think, to an individual, when asked, have been clear that we will never, ever, in any way, shape, or form, be part of the United States. America is not Canada. Look at the ceremony we just have. You could not have had that ceremony. You would not have that ceremony in America. Look at the cabinet behind me. You would not have that cabinet in America. You do not have that cabinet in America. We are a very fundamentally different country.
Yeah, Brianna, before that, he actually said the words, in terms of Canada becoming the 51st state, it's crazy. His point is crazy. That's it. Now, part of this is obviously due to the fact that we are likely to be in an election campaign in Canada within the next few days. And this is really him standing up for nationalism, something that is definitely popular in Canada right now. But Brianna, you'll forgive the entire election campaign, because some days it will seem as if everyone is campaigning against U.S. President Donald Trump and not against each other, the politicians that will be running within just a few days.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. So he is now the first unelected prime minister in more than 40 years. That means he's not technically a part of parliament. For those who are not intimately familiar with the Canadian political process, how does that impact his duties and how he can carry them out as prime minister?
It doesn't affect his duties at all, but we always revolve around this word mandate. What does mandate mean? It means you want the people to elect you so that you have the full power, the full backing of the Canadian people. And whether you're in the Oval Office or anywhere else, you go there knowing that Canadians elected you. And that's why we will likely have an election campaign in Canada in the next few days. As I said, his style completely different. We did notice in the press conference, and he has been this way before. He can get a bit brittle and a bit short with questions. It'll be interesting to see how he campaigns and the pivot that he does make. As you said, from being a rookie politician, he is going to have to study up pretty quickly.
Yeah, can't be brittle in politics. Paula Newton, thank you so much for that report.
We asked parents who adopted teens to share their journey.
I think my biggest challenge was getting through to him to understand that love is real, and you have goals in mind, you have things that want to happen, and I want to help you get there.
Sometimes people tend to shy away from wanting to adopt teenagers because they feel like they've lost so much, but there's still so much to gain.
Just knowing that there's just that other person that cares and loves me out there, it feels great. And they've done so much for me, and I can only be appreciative every single day for just having them in my life.
I think it's been the best decision because I gained a son, and he's the best son ever. If I was down and out, he'd be there.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to learn more.
Farming is dangerous. There's dangers all around us. We work around it and we live around it every day. And we just become desensitized to what's around us.
We go through safety training and, you know, we try and do these things to make sure accidents don't happen. But you just never know.
There are so many farmers that I think take for granted all of the underground utilities
that are there.
You don't want to hit a gas pipe because that's your life. The other part of it is if you hit certain things, you're liable for it.
I mean, we kind of know what's out here, but all at the same time, you just always call.
FarmSafe 811 starts with you. Whether you're installing drain tile or doing any sort of digging, always call 811 and wait for any underground lines to be marked and have the depth confirmed. That's farming with care. But if a line does get damaged, go somewhere safe and call 911.
Always keep safety in the back of your mind. Just stay humble.
For more information, go to farmsafe811.org.
This is Law and Disorder.